Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander and Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the March 12th, 2021 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week is a restaurant scene. There are four people, all older adults, older Americans. The restaurant's well lit. They've got their plates in front of them, and they're all toasting, glass of red wine, smiling and laughing. And then in the window outside, it looks gray and dark, and there's a couple of masked people, a woman and a man, that look just really concerned, looking through the window, just can't believe what they're seeing. The title is Vaccine Envy. How much longer will millions of people feel left out? And that is our first main story. We'll start with it. Vaccines ramping up rapidly. What happened? Hopes that the end of the pandemic is in sight rose this week as President Biden announced that the U.S. will have enough coronavirus vaccine for every adult in America by the end of May, 2 months sooner than previously projected. With tens of millions of new doses due to arrive in coming weeks, the president said, the federal government will make immunizing all teachers by the end of March a priority. Biden accelerated his vaccine timeline after the FDA gave emergency authorization to a third COVID-19 vaccine, a single-shot regimen from Johnson & Johnson, which shipped 3.9 million doses this week. With help from the administration in obtaining supplies and logistics, Johnson & Johnson will make vaccines around the clock and plans to produce 94 million doses by June. To speed production, the White House brokered a historic deal for pharmaceutical giant Merck to dedicate two of its facilities to making the vaccine of its rival, Johnson & Johnson. Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech have pledged to deliver enough of their two-dose vaccines to protect 200 million Americans by the end of May, meaning there will be enough shots to cover all 260 million eligible adults. Over the past week, the pace of vaccinations increased to nearly 2 million doses a day. So far, about 53 million people have received at least one dose of a coronavirus vaccine, or about 16% of the adult population. But in a troubling sign, infections appear to plateau this week at 67,000 new cases per day after weeks of sharp declines. There continue to be roughly 2,000 COVID-19 fatalities a day, bringing the U.S. death toll above 515,000. Texas is suffering more daily deaths than any state except California, but Republican Governor Greg Abbott lifted Texas' mask mandate this week and allowed all businesses to return to full capacity. Texas is open 100%, he tweeted, everything. Mississippi also dropped all restrictions. Some restrictions were eased in Arkansas, North Carolina, Virginia, California, Massachusetts, and New York. Health officials warned that relaxed rules and highly infectious coronavirus variants could lead to a fourth wave of infections. The UK strain now accounts for roughly 10% of all U.S. cases. At this level of cases, with variants spreading, said the Centers for Disease Control Director Rochelle Walensky, we stand to completely lose the hard-earned ground we have gained. What the editorial said. Abbott thinks coronavirus safety measures are needed only when people are so sick that they are overrunning hospitals, said the Houston Chronicle. But mask mandates actually help businesses stay open by slowing the virus spread, and lifting them puts unfair pressure on businesses to get Billy Bob to comply with basic safety protocols. The U.S. now has the upper hand against COVID, said the New York Post. It's absurd to paint it any other way. Hospitalizations have dropped every day since January 13th, except for February 17th. New cases are a quarter what they were 6 weeks ago. Millions of Americans who've had COVID already have natural immunity, and with tens of millions more getting vaccinated, the U.S. should start moving rapidly to normalcy, restoring jobs, reopening schools, and reclaiming our social lives. What the columnist said. Many Americans are seesawing from hope to despair, said Amy Davidson Sorkin in NewYorker.com. Vaccines are now rolling out rapidly, but the news about spreading variants is creating new fears and doubt. However, Johnson & Johnson's vaccine held up well in large-scale trials in South Africa, where an alarming variant emerged. Still, joy can be hard to come by with relaxed rules exposing states to fresh outbreaks, and the U.S. daily death rate still quadruple what it was last July. But with luck and vigilance, the worst of the pandemic is likely behind us. The virus won't vanish completely, but the crisis portion of the pandemic is nearly over, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com. No one's going to have to worry about 6 feet of social distance at the 4th of July backyard barbecue. By summer, it will be time to go to baseball games, concerts, and outdoor festivals. People will fill restaurants, movie theaters, churches, airplanes, and schools, and the mask police will fall silent. Sounds heavenly, doesn't it? If that all sounds too dangerous, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com, you might be suffering from zeroism. It's the belief adopted by many traumatized liberals after Trump's willful indifference to 500,000 deaths that we are safe only when there's zero risk of infection. Zeroists think vaccinated people shouldn't hug and schools should remain closed unless every American is inoculated. But in deciding when to return to normal life, we need to make a rational cost-benefit analysis. Kids desperately need to return to school, and we all badly need hugs, friends, and fun. Our controversy of the week is titled CPAC. Is there a GOP without Trumpism? Do you miss me yet? Asked Donald Trump, emerging from the seclusion of a Mar-a-Lago to keynote last week's conservative political action conference. The crowd roared in a demonstration of its devotion, said Elena Plott in the New York Times. At the four-day event, the mood was defiantly pro-Trump, with ubiquitous MAGA hats and fans posing for photos with a six-foot golden statue of Trump holding a magic wand, recalling for many critics the Old Testament's ill-fated golden calf. Lest any doubt remain, CPAC attendees told reporters their allegiance was to the former president far more than to the Republican Party. The conservative movement used to be defined by ideas, but it's now devolved into reverence for one man. Trump's speech was a tired repeat of his usual own the libs grievances, said E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post, with an emphasis on the big lie that the 2020 election was stolen from him. But his heart didn't seem in his hint that I may even decide to run again in 2024. He grew passionate only in demanding vengeance for the 17 GOP lawmakers who voted to remove him from office, whom he took the time to list by name. Get rid of them all, he snarled, all of which puts Republicans in a bind. Party leaders in their hearts know that they can't win with Trump and Trumpism, especially after the January 6th insurrection. But as CPAC made clear, they can't live without him and his followers. Trump should not run again, said Eddie Scarry in WashingtonExaminer.com. But he is still crucial to the party's future. He has revolutionized the conservative movement by championing an America First working class agenda and creating a blueprint for future Republicans to win national office. At CPAC, Trump signaled his willingness to be a kingmaker rather than a king, said Miranda Devine in the New York Post, disavowing rumors that he planned to start a third party. With exciting young conservatives like Governors Ron DeSantis and Kristi Noem waiting to pick up Trump's populist torch of personal liberty, economic nationalism, and national pride, this bodes well for the GOP's future. As a Republican, I was heartened to hear Trump shooting down the idea of a third party, said Scott Jennings in CNN.com. Splitting our voter base would condemn the GOP to perpetual defeat. But we're also not going to win if our voter base gets any smaller. In both 2016 and 2020, Trump got a smaller percentage of the popular vote than Mitt Romney did in 2012. Trumpism, as he and his cult made clear at CPAC, is pure revanchism, said Jonathan Last in TheBulwark.com. It consists of little more than a white, largely male minority's grievance-driven hunger to return to a time when they held power. These angry populists have zero interest in trying to woo back the millions of disgusted moderates and suburban women who emphatically rejected Trump in 2020. Republicans may run a Trumpist in 2024, said Osita Noivinu in NewRepublic.com, but not Trump himself. He'll be 78 by then if he hasn't already been yanked from the stage by Father Time or the circling prosecutors in New York, Georgia, and Washington, D.C. Unlike his golden effigy made in Mexico, it turns out, from a fiberglass shell coated in gold veneer, the man isn't immortal. With his unique combination of shameless bombast and theatrical victimhood, Trump will be a tough act to follow. But sooner or later, some Republican will have to follow him. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems it was a good week for diplomacy. After the Japanese government asked China to stop testing Japanese tourists for COVID using anal swabs. The efficacy of the test has not been confirmed anywhere else in the world, said a Japanese official, and they cause great psychological pain. It was a good week for redesigns after Amazon tweaked the look of a button on its new iPhone app following complaints it looked like a smirking Adolf Hitler. Amazon did not address the Hitler resemblance, but said the new icon would better spark anticipation, excitement, and joy. And it was a good week for Donald Trump, who was re-inaugurated as president on March 4th, followed by mass arrest of Democrats and deep state conspirators. The prophesied storm had not begun as the week went to press, but QAnon believers were aglow with confidence. March 4th will be our victory dance, one Debbie Briscoe posted. But it was a bad week for low blows after the far right wing Newsmax network ran a segment accusing Champ, President Biden's 12-year-old German Shepherd, of looking dirty and unpresidential. It was a bad week for persistence after rock guitar virtuoso Steve Vai needed finger surgery because he held the same complex chord for 20 minutes in a practice session. I had to put my thumb in this really weird position, explained the former Frank Zappa protege, now 60. Finally, it was a bad week for multitasking. After Dr. Scott Green, a California plastic surgeon, attempting to zoom in to a traffic court appearance with an anesthetized patient lying unconscious behind him, I have another surgeon right here, Green told an unconvinced Commissioner Gary Link, who insisted on rescheduling the hearing. Mm-hmm. The title of our briefing page article is COVID's Assault on Native Americans. The coronavirus has taken a devastating toll on indigenous communities across the U.S. How bad were the outbreaks? Native Americans and Alaska Natives have been hit harder by the pandemic than any other community in the U.S. They are 3.5 times more likely to be infected with COVID-19 than whites and are 1.8 times more likely to die from the disease, according to the Centers for Disease Control. Nationwide, one in every 475 Native Americans has died from the coronavirus, compared to one in 645 African Americans, another hard-hit group. In Mississippi, one in every 127 indigenous people has died of COVID-19. In the Navajo Nation, a sprawling reservation that straddles Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah, and is home to 175,000 people, more than 1,150 have died, a rate of about 1 in 160. Last May, the reservation registered the highest infection rate in the U.S. The pandemic has worsened severe substance abuse issues and poverty on reservations, in part because of the shuttering of Native-run casinos. Everyone has been impacted, said Amber Kanazba-Krati, a Navajo Tribal Council delegate. Some families have been decimated. Why such a heavy toll? It's partly because Native communities are so poor and have had such limited access to health care. In some remote areas, there is one hospital for an area the size of Delaware. And the Indian Health Service, a federal program that serves 2.6 million people, is underfunded and understaffed. A third of Native Americans live in poverty, and the population disproportionately suffers from chronic health conditions, including obesity, diabetes, liver disease, hypertension, and respiratory disease, that heighten the risk of dying from COVID. Even before the pandemic, Native Americans had an average life expectancy 5.5 years lower than the national average. We're more at risk of COVID because we are Native people living in the U.S., where we have been experiencing this kind of oppression for the past 500 years, said Abigail Echo Hawk, chief research officer at the Seattle Indian Health Board and a member of the Pawnee Nation. Many Natives live in crowded, multi-generational households, exacerbating spread to vulnerable old people. As of mid-January, 565 of the Navajo Nation's 869 deaths were among people aged 60 and older. The loss of so many elders has been uniquely devastating to Native communities. Why is that? Elders are revered in Native communities and serve as repositories of history and culture. They pass down Native languages, oral histories, songs, prayers, medical knowledge, and cultural traditions. It's like we're having a cultural book burning, said Jason Salzman, a spokesman for Oklahoma's Muscogee Nation. We're losing a historical record. In the Navajo Nation, many Hatali, practitioners of traditional medicine, have died. Among the Cherokee, who in 2019 initiated a program to preserve their dying language, dozens of the remaining speakers have been lost to COVID over the past year. Our language, culture, and traditions is what makes us Cheyenne, said Desi Rodriguez Lone Bear, a Cheyenne and an assistant professor of American Indian Studies at the University of California. But we're losing our teachers. What is being done? In some areas, tribal leaders have instituted safety measures beyond state and local mandates. In the Navajo Nation, they've banned large gatherings, organized pro-masking campaigns, and enforced curfews and stay-at-home orders, putting up checkpoints and threatening violators with fines and jail terms. Some tribes, such as the Eastern Band of Cherokee in North Carolina and Oglala Sioux in South Dakota, have at times barred non-residents from reservations. On the federal level, $8 billion was allocated to Native American communities as part of the first coronavirus relief package last March. The many natives complained that a months-long delay in allocating the money cost lives. In early February, President Biden signed a major disaster declaration for the Navajo Nation that cleared the way for additional federal funding for vaccine distribution and medical staffing. Are Native Americans getting vaccinated? Yes. In fact, Native communities are well ahead of the general population when it comes to inoculating their members. Over half of the Navajo Nation residents have received at least one shot. For example, while the Rosebud Sioux of South Dakota have been inoculated at double the state rate. With the virus rampaging through the reservations, tribes have created aggressive outreach programs to get vaccines to remote populations. A strong sense of community and fear of extinction has increased compliance rates. In a recent survey, 75% of Native Americans said they'd be willing to get the vaccine, 20 percentage points above the general population. The main motivation, the study reported, was a strong sense of responsibility to protect the Native community and preserve cultural ways. The high Navajo vaccination rates are enough to give our people real hope, said Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez. We got through smallpox, we got through tuberculosis, and we will get through this. Still, tribal leaders express concern about damage to their communities that will be felt long after the pandemic passes. I fear the long-term impacts on mental health, our children, community resilience, and cohesiveness, said Rodriguez Lone Bear. We're in the middle of a massive storm, and we're not prepared for the aftermath. Move into a few of the best columns of the week. The first two come from the U.S. Brett Stevens of the New York Times writes a column titled, When Every White Person is a Racist. To see how woke culture has transformed American universities, said Brett Stevens, consider a recent incident at Smith College. Student Umu Kanuti was eating lunch in an empty dorm lounge when a campus security told her to leave. Kanuti alleged racism, saying in a Facebook post that started a national firestorm, "All I did was be black." A white janitor she blamed for summoning security was put on leave. The university president issued profuse apologies, and the college required staff to take anti-racism training. But as a story in the Times detailed last week, the narrative of racist harassment of a minority student at an elitist white institution turned out to be comprehensively false. Kanute had gone into a dorm that was closed for the summer, and security had been told to tell all unauthorized people to leave. Nonetheless, anti-racism consultants hired by Smith pressed all white employees to confess their bigotry and asked them intrusive questions about their parents' racial attitudes. One administrator quit in protest. Why have racial tensions boiled over at so many of the nation's liberal arts colleges? When students are steeped in critical race theory and microaggressions, it's not surprising they see racism everywhere. Postmaster DeJoy must go. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy wants to slow down the mail and raise rates, said Paul Waldman. Summoned to a hearing by a congressional committee last week, DeJoy, a political appointee of President Trump, was defiant about these goals, saying, "Get used to me." That same day, President Joe Biden appointed three new members to the Postal Board of Governors, giving Democrats a majority. DeJoy should be fired at the first available opportunity. DeJoy was given the postal job after he donated millions to Trump and Republicans, despite a history of abusive practices at his supply chain business. to reduce the USPS's losses, DeJoy immediately ordered cost-cutting measures, which resulted in massive delivery delays during the holidays. He has a new plan to slow down first-class mail even further while jacking up rates. The Postal Service is a widely beloved agency, delivering vital prescriptions, bills, checks, and periodicals to even the most rural parts of the country. It needs reform, particularly regarding its obligation to pre-fund pensions, but DeJoy is such a belligerent, polarizing figure that he can't provide credible leadership. As soon as possible, he should be sent packing. This column comes from Russia. Amnesty does the Kremlin's bidding. Amnesty International has turned itself into the Kremlin's useful idiot, said Artemy Troitsky. The human rights group has designated Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny a prisoner of conscience, which he clearly is. Navalny has ostensibly been locked up for parole violations. The real reason for his detention is that he has repeatedly exposed the corruption of President Vladimir Putin's regime. But after Kremlin instigators bombarded Amnesty with requests to label Navalny's past nationalist comments as hate speech, the group stripped him of his prisoner of conscience status. What did Navalny do that was so terrible? Is it his support for Russia's annexation of Crimea? That is a political opinion, not hate speech. Is it that during 2008 Russian-Georgian War, Navalny referred to Georgians as rodents? That's shameful, but he has apologized for it 1,000 times. Navalny's videos do inspire hatred, but it's hatred of dictatorship and tyranny, theft and corruption. Amnesty's criticism of Navalny won't affect his reputation here, but it will trash the group's reputation among Russian activists, which was surely the Kremlin's goal. Amnesty has done Putin a huge favor in smearing his opponent and wounded itself in the process. Time for the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, Now Type In Your Bank Password. From offices in Kolkata, scam callers try to separate Americans from their money, said Udit Bhattacharya in the New York Times Magazine. With the help of anti-scam hacker, I went to find them. One afternoon in December 2019, Kathleen Langer, an elderly grandmother who lives by herself in Crossville, Tennessee, got a phone call from a person who said he worked in the refund department of her computer manufacturer. The reason for the call, he explained, was to process a refund the company owed Langer for antivirus and anti-hacking protections that had been sold to her and was now being discontinued. Langer, who has a warm and kind voice, couldn't remember purchasing the plan in question, but at her age, she didn't quite trust her memory. She had no reason to doubt the caller, who spoke with an Indian accent and said his name was Roger. He asked her to turn on a computer and led her through the steps so that he could access it remotely. When Langer asked why this was necessary, he said he needed to remove the software from her machine. After he gained access to her desktop using the program TeamViewer, the caller asked Langer to log into her bank to accept the refund, $399, which he was going to transfer into her account. Langer made a couple of unsuccessful attempts to log in. She couldn't remember her username. Frustrated, the caller opened her bank's internet banking registration form on her computer screen, created a new username and password for her, and asked her to fill out the required details, including her address, social security number, and birth date. When she typed this last part in, the caller noticed she had turned 80 weeks earlier and wished her happy birthday. "Thank you," she replied. After submitting the form, he tried to log into Longer's account but failed because Longer's bank activates a newly created user ID only after speaking to the customer who has requested it. The caller asked Langer if she could go to her bank to resolve the issue. Because it was late in the afternoon, however, she wasn't sure if the bank would be open when she got there. The caller noted that the bank didn't close until 4:30, which meant she still had 45 minutes. "He was very insistent," Langer told me repeatedly. On her computer screen, the caller typed out what he wanted her to say at the bank. "Don't tell them anything about the refund," he said. Later, Langer rang the number the caller had given her and told her that she had been unable to get to the bank in time. By now, she was beginning to have doubts about the caller. She told him she wouldn't answer the phone if he contacted her again. "Do you care about your computer?" he asked. He then uploaded a program onto her computer called Lock My PC and locked its screen with a password she couldn't see. "If you want to use your computer as you were doing, you need to go ahead as I was telling you, or else you will lose your computer and your money," he told her. When he finally hung up, Langer felt shaken. Minutes later, her phone rang again. This caller introduced himself as Jim Browning. "The guy who is trying to convince you to sign into your online banking account is after one thing alone, and that is he wants to steal your money," he said. Langer was mystified that this new caller, who had what seemed to be a strong Irish accent, knew about the conversation she had just had. "Are you sure you are not with this group?" she asked. He replied that the same scammers had targeted him too, but when they were trying to connect remotely to his computer, he had managed to secure access to theirs. For weeks, that remote connection had allowed him to eavesdrop on and record calls like those with Longer. "I'm going to give you the password to unlock your PC, because they use the same password every time," he said. "If you type 4521, you'll unlock it." Longer keyed in the digits. "Okay, it came back on," she said, relieved. For most people, calls like the one Longer received are a source of annoyance or anxiety. According to FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center, the total losses reported to it by scams victims increased to $3.5 billion in 2019 from $1.4 billion in 2017. The person who rescued Longer delights in getting these calls, however. "I'm fascinated by scams," he told me. A software engineer based in the United Kingdom, he runs a YouTube channel under the pseudonym Jim Browning, where he regularly posts videos about his fraud-fighting efforts. I'll refer to him by his middle initial, L. L started going after scammers when a relative of his lost money to a tech support swindle, a common scheme with many variants. Often it starts when the mark gets a call from someone offering to help in ridding a computer's hard drive of malware. In other instances, victims are tricked by a pop-up warning that their computer is at risk and that they need to call a certain number. Once someone is on the phone, the scammers talk the caller into opening up a remote access application on his or her computer, after which they get the victim to read back unique identifying information that allows them to establish control over their computer. L flips the script. He starts by playing an unsuspecting target and allows the scammer to connect to his device. This doesn't have any of his actual data, however. It is a virtual machine, a program that simulates a functioning desktop on his computer. The scammer's connection to L's virtual machine is a two-way street that allows L to connect to the scammer's computer and infect it with his own software. Once he has done this, he can monitor the scammer's activities. Sitting in his home office, L is able to listen in on calls between scammer and targets and watch as the scammer takes control of the victim's computer. On occasion, L succeeds in turning on the scammer's webcam and is able to record video of the scammer. From the IP address of the scammer's computer and other clues, L frequently manages to identify the neighborhood and, in some cases, the actual building where the call center is. When he encounters a scam in progress, L tries to both document and disrupt it, as he did in the case of Kathleen Longer. Like L, I was curious to learn more about phone scammers, having received dozens of their calls over the years. Sometimes during my interviews with him, L would begin monitoring a call between a scammer and a mark and let me listen in. In some instances, I would also hear other call center employees in the background, some of them making similar calls, others talking among themselves. The chatter evoked a busy workplace, reminding me of my late nights in Kolkata newsroom where I began my journalism career 25 years ago. When scammers called me in the past, they were frequently had South Asian accents, leading me to suspect that they were calling from India. I had tried cajoling them into telling me about their enterprise, but never succeeded. Now, with L's help, I thought, I might have better luck. I flew to India at the end of 2019, hoping to visit some of the call centers that L had identified. Although he detected scams originating from Delhi and other Indian cities, L was convinced that Kolkata had emerged as the capital of such frauds. I knew that city well, having covered the crime beat there for an English language daily in the mid-1990s. In my notebook were a couple of addresses that L identified as possible origins for some scam calls. I also had the identity of a person linked to one of these spots, a young man whose first name is Shabazz. L identified him by matching images and several government-issued IDs found on his computer. The home address on his ID matched what L determined from the IP address to be the site of the call center where he operated, which suggested that the call center was located where he lived or close by. One afternoon, I drove to Garden Reach, a predominantly Muslim and largely poor section in southwest Kolkata. I was looking for Shabazz. The apartment I sought was in a building at the end of the alley. It was locked, but a woman next door said that the building belonged to Shabazz's family and that he lived in one of the apartments with his parents. Then I saw an elderly couple seated on the steps in the front. His parents, it turned out. The father summoned Shabazz's brother, who said Shabazz had gone out. They gave me Shabazz's mobile number, but when I called, I got no answer. Eventually, I pulled the brother aside and told him that I was a journalist and wanted to meet his brother because I learned he was a scammer. I hoped he would pass on my message. I got a call from Shabazz a few hours later. He denied that he'd ever worked at a call center. I persisted, but he kept brushing me off until I asked him to confirm that his birthday was a few days later in December. "Look, you are telling me my exact birth date. That makes me nervous," he said. He wanted to know what I knew about him. 2 days later, we met for lunch at the Taj Bengal, one of Kolkata's five-star hotels. I'd chosen that as the venue out of concern for my safety. When he showed up in the hotel lobby, however, I felt a little silly. Physically, Shabazz is hardly intimidating. He is short and skinny with a face that would seem babyish, but for his thin mustache and beard. We sat down at a secluded table in the hotel's Chinese restaurant. I took out my phone and played a video that L had made of a call in which Shabazz was trying to defraud a woman in Ottawa. On the call, he can be heard threatening her. "You don't want to lose all your money, right?" I watched him shift uncomfortably in his chair. "Whose voice is that?" I asked. "It's yours, isn't it? He nodded in silence. Shabazz told me that sometime around 2011 or 2012, a friend took him to a call center where he got his first job in scamming. In his first few jobs, Shabazz earned a modest salary. He told me that the first call center paid him less than $100 a month. In 2016 or 2017, he began working with a group of scammers in Garden Reach, earning a share of the profits. It was hard to ascertain how much this group was stealing from victims, but Shabazz confessed that he was able to defraud one or two people every night, extracting anywhere from $200 to $300 per victim. He was paid about a quarter of the stolen amount. The more we spoke, the more I recognized that Shabazz was a small figure in a gigantic criminal ecosystem of the phone scam industry, the equivalent of a pickpocket on a Calcutta bus. Shabazz was a reluctant interviewee, giving me guarded answers that were less than candid or directly contradicted evidence that L had collected. He was vague about the highest amount he'd ever stolen from a victim, at one point saying $800, then later admitting $1,500. I found it hard to trust either figure, because one of his November calls, I heard him bullying someone to pay $5,000. He told me that my visit to his house had left him shaken, causing him to realize how wrong he was to be defrauding people. And so, he had quit scamming, he told me. I knew he was not telling the truth. 2 days earlier, hours after our first phone conversation, Shabazz had been at it again. It was on that night, in fact, that he tried to swindle Kathleen Longer in Crossville, Tennessee. Before I came to see him for lunch, I had already heard a recording of that call, which L shared with me. L told me that the access he had to Shabazz's computer went cold after I met him on December 14, 2019, but it buzzed back to life about 10 weeks later. The IP address was the same as before, which suggested that it was operating in the same location I visited. L set up a live stream on YouTube so I could see what L was observing. The microphone was on, and L and I could clearly hear people making scam calls in the background. It appeared that Shabazz had turned the computer on to download music. I couldn't say for certain, but it seemed that he was taking a moment to chill in the middle of another long night at work. This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in the New York Times. Read a couple of the health and science pieces this week. Starting with worries over new U.S. COVID variants. Two homegrown variants of the coronavirus are rapidly spreading in California and the New York City metro area, raising fears among scientists that the strains could cause a nationwide spike in infections and deaths. On the West Coast, new research suggests that the California variant is more contagious and more likely to cause sickness and death than the previously dominant form of COVID-19, reports the Los Angeles Times. It also appears more resistant to antibodies generated by a COVID-19 vaccine or prior infection. While the strain wasn't the main driver of California's winter surge in infections and fatalities, it rose from complete obscurity to accounting for 50% of the examined coronavirus samples in just 5 months. Meanwhile, studies found that the New York variant, which first appeared in November, now accounts for 1 in 4 viral samples collected in the city. It, too, appears to be more dangerous than earlier strains, with infected patients more likely to be hospitalized and more resistant to vaccines. The emergence of these new variants comes as health officials were already bracing for the impact of the highly infectious UK strain, which is expected to become the dominant U.S. strain this month. The devil is already here, said infectious disease researchers Charles Chu from the University of California, San Francisco. I wish it were different, but the science is the science. A magnetic catastrophe. About 42,000 years ago, Earth's magnetic poles flipped. Previous research has suggested that this event, which happens every now and then, cosmically speaking, had little impact. But a new study suggests that this switch, in fact, caused drastic environmental and climatic changes around the planet, reports The Guardian. Earth's magnetic field acts as a shield against damaging solar radiation. When the poles switch or wobble, that protection weakens, leaving the planet more exposed to high-energy particles. Using radiocarbon analysis on the fossilized remains of kauri trees, which can live for thousands of years, from New Zealand, researchers were able to pinpoint the specific 800-year period when the magnetic flip occurred. The researchers then looked at archaeological and climate records from that period and found that numerous environmental changes took place around the world. Tropical rain belts shifted dramatically, an ice sheet started to stretch across North America, and a severe drought in Australia led to a die-off of megafauna. Co-author Chris Turney from the University of New South Wales says that the rise in the use of caves by our ancestors around this time may be down to the fact that they offered shelter from the harsh conditions outside. It probably would have seemed like the end of days. Endangered species cloned. Scientists have for the first time cloned a U.S. endangered species using genes from an animal that died more than 20 years ago. Elizabeth Ann, a black-footed ferret, was born last December in Fort Collins, Colorado. Her species has distinctive dark eye markings, feeds exclusively on prairie dogs, and was thought to have gone extinct decades ago when ranchers shot and poisoned off its favorite meal. But after a ranch dog found and killed one of the ferrets in Wyoming in 1981, scientists gathered the remaining critters and launched a captive breeding program. That has been a success, reports the Associated Press, but the ferrets it has produced are so closely related and genetically similar that they could easily be wiped out by a parasite or disease. The ferret cloned to produce Elizabeth Ann isn't related to that population, so Elizabeth Ann and future clones can potentially be used to reduce the population's vulnerability. Conservation needs more tools in the toolbox, said Ryan Phelan, co-founder of the biotech firm Revive and Restore, which helped create Elizabeth Ann. Cloning is just one of those tools. And we're on the Talking Points page. Time for a couple of articles here today, I think. Starting with Potato Head, now gender nonconforming. Mr. Potato Head has come out as non-binary, said Amanda Arnold in TheCut.com. Hasbro, the maker of the 70-year-old toy vegetable, said last week it was dropping the gender from the official name and would refer to him simply as Potato Head. A Hasbro executive explained that culture has evolved, adding that Mr. and Mrs. setup was limiting for both gender identity and family structure. In other words, Hasbro wants to sell Potato Heads to kids with two mommies or two daddies. Conservatives threw a fit in response to news that a little plastic potato would no longer be known as a man, with one bemoaning the loss of an apparently important male figure, and another contending that it was time for Republican states to secede. On Fox News and its business channel, it was a huge story, said Alexis Bevisice in CNN.com. Mr. Potato Head was mentioned no fewer than 35 times by Fox hosts and a parade of experts who denounced Hasbro for what they saw as a left-wing attack on traditional family values. We conservatives are freaking out about Mr. Potato Head not because of some sentimental and overblown attachment to the child's toy, said Kylie Zimpel in TheFederalist.com. Rather, it's an unmistakable symbol of how the left won't stop until they erase sex and gender distinctions from everything. Just last week, the House of Representatives passed the Equality Act, which would ostensibly prohibit discrimination but would, in practice, eradicate legal sex distinctions as we now know them. with the trans kids competing against girls and showering in their locker rooms. If progressives have their way, they'll potato head all of America. A plastic, googly-eyed potato was hardly a paragon of masculinity, said E.J. Dixon in RollingStone.com. So why are white conservative men so upset? They're frantic that they are losing their majority status and power, and yearn for a bygone day when men were men, women were women, and everyone, even toys, knew their place. In nature, potatoes are actually gender nonconforming, said Alex Knapp in Forbes.com. Each plant possesses both male and female flowers, as well as the ability to reproduce asexually. So Hasbro is just making its toy more true to nature. Like its earthy ancestor, Potato Head has interchangeable parts. Vaccine envy, the new national epidemic. In my house, we have a problem, said Nicholas Goldberg in the Los Angeles Times. My wife has been vaccinated. I haven't. When she got her second shot, I couldn't help feeling that she had crossed safely to the other side of a giant chasm while I remained at the edge of the cliff. She can now go out safely while I continue to cower at home. Like millions of other Americans, I am suffering from a bad case of vaccine envy. So far, about 15% of the U.S. population has gotten at least one shot. Vaccinated seniors have resumed socializing with one another and are racing to book vacations. For months, we will be a two-tiered society of haves and have-nots, with the vaccinated returning to a normality that remains forbidden to the rest of us. I haven't wished I was older since I was a teenager, said Karina Bland in the Arizona Republic. But now, scrolling through social media and seeing one vaccine selfie after another, I want to be 65. I'm even more jealous of younger people who meet their state's eligibility requirements, like my friend who qualifies as an educator because he works for a high school drama department. When a pharmacist friend got vaccinated before me, said Jean Weingarten in the Washington Post, I hated her, which filled me with self-loathing. The Germans probably have a word for this complex feeling. Call it Schadenfreude. When I finally did book an appointment after a week of trying, I'm 69, I felt guilty for being one of the select few, while tens of millions still remain unprotected. Vaccine envy will lead to months of vaccine awkwardness, said Rachel Gutman in TheAtlantic.com. Our social interactions will be defined by who's protected and who isn't. Early data indicate that COVID-19 vaccines stop at least some transmission, but it's still possible that vaccinated people can serve as asymptomatic carriers and infect others. So if you've gotten your shots, determining what's safe to do depends on whether your neighbors, family, grocery clerks, delivery drivers, and friends who are still vulnerable to the virus. The immunized can safely eat together, and vaccinated seniors can go ahead and hug their grandkids. But until herd immunity is reached, people who've gotten the shots should still wear masks when indoor public places and avoid crowds. If vaccinated people throw caution to the wind, they'll only be prolonging this pandemic nightmare. And some of the shorter notes. As gun sales boomed during the pandemic, the number of mass shootings in America or incidents in which four or more people were injured or killed soared 47% during 2020 to 611. In all, 513 people were killed in these shootings, and 2,543 were injured. At least 160 public Confederate statues and other symbols were taken down or moved out of public spaces last year, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center. About 700 Confederate monuments remain across the U.S. New COVID cases among nursing home residents plunged from late December to early February by more than 80% and deaths by 65%, as residents began receiving vaccine shots. "I'm almost at a loss for words for how amazing it is and how exciting," said David Gifford, the chief medical officer for the American Healthcare Association. FBI officials say they are looking for a single unidentified suspect in the killing of Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick on January 6th. The suspect is seen on video spraying Sicknick with bear spray in the face. An hour after fighting with rioters, Sicknick collapsed and died, not as a result of being hit with a fire extinguisher, as police originally said, but in an apparent reaction to the toxic spray. And we'll finish this show with a quote from Lenny Bruce, quoted in the New York Times, who says, "There's nothing sadder than an old hipster." And with that, we have run out of time for our show. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. And we thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.